So welcome. It's a lovely night in New England. We are honored, Amherst is honored, I am honored, to welcome David Mayhew back home to his alma mater, a graduate from the class of 1958, who has had an amazing academic career. At the University of Massachusetts, here at the college, as he told us this evening, teaching a bit. And then starting in 1968 at Yale University, rising fairly quickly to be the Cal's Professor of Government. And since 1998, holding the most esteemed chair in the discipline or academe, I said as a Yalie, which is the Sterling Professorship at Yale of Political Science. His honors are too many to mention in a brief introduction, include the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, Guggenheim's, the Institute at the Center, at Palo Alto. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has been since 1984. He's the winner of the Neustadt Prize for Divided We Govern and the American Political Science Association's Most Distinguished James Madison Award for Career Achievement. His books are landmarks in political science, going back, as I recall, starting in 1974 with, there's a book before that, but the book that we all were assigned, certainly when I was once a budding political scientist, Congress, the Electoral Connection, Divided We Govern, America's Congress, most recently Parties and Policies, and many between, and many articles as well. David Mayhew teaches us that what seems obvious may not be at all, and what was not obvious seems somehow to be after David has explained it to us. David Mayhew has shown us that the dysfunctions of American democracy are sometimes dysfunctions, but they are also, in ways that perhaps the founders understood, as we sometimes understand, but as David has always understood, sometimes those apparent dysfunctions are actually quite functional for governance after all. David Mayhew is the paragon in political science of doing precise and important, empirical studies of our own polity. I don't have a television, as I admitted tonight, so I have no idea whether all the commentators on the current political race are as precise and important as David Mayhew, but I suspect not. Please join me in welcoming to talk tonight about the incumbent advantages of the presidency and the historical perspective on the elections for the presidency, David Mayhew.
Thanks very much, Tony, my friend, Tony Marks, President Marks. It's great to be back here. I was here a long time ago, class of 1958. We're all coming back to be reassembled this spring in a reunion, and you have to come back on your 50th, as I'm going to do it. I still have friends here, President Marks. Dan DeSalvo, I know, who's teaching here, I think. Professor Taubman, Professor Arcus, our acquaintances, friends going way back, and it's great to be back. So presidential elections is my subject. I'm going to take my coat off. Now, in this year, we are experiencing a particularly interesting and exciting one. They're watching it all over the world. They're glued to the television sets in Paris and Slovenia, you name it, watching what's going on with Obama and Clinton and McCain. It's really quite extraordinary. I wouldn't be surprised if other countries start copying the American presidential primary system. Like, why can't we do this? They're saying in Bulgaria and Slovenia right now. Now, we can't tell who's winning, who'll win. I'm not going to say that. I think anybody, if you find somebody who tells you he's going to win this election in November, I've got a bridge I could sell you. Nobody really knows. It's not out there. There's too much contingency between now and then, so don't believe anybody. On current evidence, I would say, we're looking at a presidential election that will be, wait, first of all, close. That's a rebuttable presumption, but it's now a fair presumption. And also, there's no telling who will win it. Which party will win it? That's where we are. We have 10 months of adventure in front of us. That's where we are. But I want to talk tonight about history rather than about 2008, as the title of my talk says. And I want to try to frame, in a way, the election of this year insofar as that can be done by calling on American history. And I want to end with some implications about the freshness and change that are inherent in the American presidential election system and as we're seeing that system perform this year. I want you to raise a hand if you can't hear me in the back, because sometimes my voice doesn't carry. So please feel free to do that. Is it carrying okay right now in the back? Are we all right? Good. Apparently the acoustics here are pretty good. I think the acoustics at Amherst are better in some places than they were 50 years ago. I'll tell you, are you going to need a tolerance for some simple statistics and a tolerance for some at least masses of historical detail? But I really want to make some pretty simple points. And I have these handouts, and I'm going to talk from the handouts, but there's a lot of information on them. If you're interested, you can just take them home and look at them again. I'm going to start with a question. Looking at presidential elections as events in which one party or the other takes over the White House, take that as the template here, which party or the other wins the White House, what is the bottom line account of what happens, if there is one, regarding the pattern of outcomes by party in presidential elections? What's really right out there if we look at patterns in the long haul? And in the U.S., after all, we have a very, very long haul going back to 1788. I think there exist three familiar accounts having to do with patterns, and I'm going to talk briefly about them and then go past them, because I'm going to develop a fourth account tonight of what happens in these presidential elections party-wise according to who wins. But let me start with the three that I want to talk about and then get rid of, or at least get past. Account one is a electoral era's realignments story about the American electoral past. And in a nutshell, it's that the American electoral past regarding the parties amounts to stable eras that go on for a while, a generation, maybe a little more, bounded by critical elections or big bang electoral changes that are boundaries between political eras, like the McKinley era and the Dewey era. We know all about that. We all went to history. We all went to high school once. At the presidential level, though, at the level of which party wins the White House in presidential elections, I don't believe that a realignment era account works very well. So let me cite a study by the statistician Daniel Gans, of which one result is quite interesting. If you take presidential elections over a 150-year period, roughly, starting in the mid-19th century through the late 20th century, and you perform on it as a statistical matter, a runs test. Think about coins. If you flip coins, you get a one head in a row, or two heads in a row, or three heads in a row, four times, sometimes five heads in a row, and then you go on to a tail. All right, you can come up with an expected distribution of runs. All right, with presidential election victories, you can play this game. Let's say Jimmy Carter is a run of one for the Democrats in 1976 to 80s, preceded and succeeded by a Republican. On the other hand, Reagan with his two terms, and Bush the father just after him is a run of three for the Republicans. Okay, we've got that. All right, the distribution of runs of party control of the presidency over 150 years doesn't differ statistically significantly from what we get by flipping coins, put it that way. It just doesn't. There's not more stability in the politics at the presidential elections level than there is through that kind of runs analysis. Now, it is, to give a side point here, it's sobering, or at least interesting. If you take presidential elections since World War II, there have been 15 presidential elections since World War II, eight times the party controlling the presidency has kept it. Seven times the party controlling the presidency has lost it. You can't get closer than that. That's real coin flipping. And if the Democrats take it this year, they'll make it 8-8. We'll get a switch over to the Dems, and that's really an evensy result. Now, in some spheres of American politics, there's more stickiness, obviously. If you take congressional elections, it's possible for one party to control the House for long periods of time stably, or the Senate for long periods of time, maybe not quite so long, stably. For example, the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for 40 years between 1954 and 1994. That's 20 elections in a row they control the House. That obviously has a lot of stickiness as a pattern. However, at the congressional level, particularly the House level, things are somewhat different. For one thing, at the House level, most of the candidates running in any election, I think in every election since 1816, are incumbents. So a party that controls the House has got an awful lot of incumbents running and probably profits from the fact of having a lot of incumbents running again for office, if there's some advantage in hearing incumbency, and there certainly is at the U.S. House level. Another difference is this between the presidential and the congressional sphere. At the presidential level, the traits of the candidates are very important, as we talked about at dinner, character and temperament and so forth. All that's very big. With the U.S. House candidates, they're less visible. Probably people vote more or less along party lines. They just don't stay glued to the tube every day. 9 o'clock tonight, people are going to watch Obama and Clinton if they're not here. It's just one of those things. You don't watch House candidates that way. So the more that voters concentrate on candidate traits, probably the more they're going to deviate from party voting, and you're going to get more less stickiness in the outcomes of presidential elections. And I think another difference between the presidency and the Congress is that it has to do with job description. As presidents, they run things. They're managers. His managerial capabilities are very important, the capacity to run something. With a senator or a House member, it really doesn't make much difference if they can't tie their shoes. With presidents, it does. They're going to be running something. House and Senate members are basically position takers, whereas presidents are basically managers. And managerial capacity can cross-cut whatever is out there in the minds of voters as they try to figure out how to vote for the presidency. So anyway, as a statistical matter, stable party eras in winning the presidency by one party or another, not really that much there in the past. Now, we can point to sequences of 3, 4, and 5 of one party controlling the presidency. We can also point to sequences of coin flips that come out that way. It's fairly common to get 3 or 4 heads in a row when you're doing coins. That's explanation number one. Explanation number two I want to mention and get past is this one. It's that whoever wins the presidency, whatever party wins the presidency, is probably the party that has an advantage out there in the electorate in party identification. Party identification, that means some people consider them Democrats themselves, Democrats voters do, some consider themselves Republicans, and if you've got an edge out there, a party does, then you probably get the presidency. Okay. That's a common sense kind of thing. But if you take this, it doesn't do very well, the presidency. There's too much deviation from advantages in party identification out there in the presidential election sphere. If you take the century, starting in a full century, the 20th century, since 1900, leaving out 2004, when the party identification of voters was roughly even, in fact, statistically even between Bush and Kerry voters among voters in 2004. If you take the 25 elections starting after 1900, in 14 instances out of the 25, the party that won the presidency, actually captured the presidency, was a party with an advantage in the country, probably at that time in party identification. In 11 instances, it was the party not with an advantage in party identification that took the presidency. That's 14 out of 25. Coin flips would give you 12.5 out of 25. So there's really not very much difference there. I mean, we have 2 Eisenhowers, 2 Nixons, 2 Reagans, Bush the father, all those are violations of the idea that PI, party identification, is going to control what happens at the presidential level. And Woodrow Wilson put 2 terms back there when the Republicans were riding probably supreme in party identification a long time ago. Account number 2. Account number 3, just briefly to be mentioned, is econometric studies of what goes on in presidential elections, or congressional for that matter. These are very good. I have no quarrel. How could I? They're beyond me, a lot of the technical aspect of it. And this is a growth stock in social science and economics as well as in poli-sci. That is, for the most part, that amounts to adducing ups and downs in the economy as explanations of party fortunes in the vote and also in the win-loss records in getting to presidential elections, and that's fine. Obviously, there's a relation there. You know, Carter has a bad problem in 1980 with a bad economy. Obviously, Herbert Hoover suffered and so forth. I don't want to quarrel with that, but it's not a complete... It's not anywhere near a complete account of what happens. I think the best studies come up with the economic variables explaining maybe a third to a half of the variance in what happens in the presidential elections, usually using the vote rather than which party wins as a dependent variable. All right, what I want to press here, what I want to flag here is a fourth account, which is the role of incumbency advantage in presidential elections. Now, we dwell on incumbency advantage a lot in studying congressional elections. The Congressman Olver is not likely to lose, and that's partly in the first district. That's partly because he's an incumbent. It's not the only reason. The Democrats are thick on the ground here. But still, there's an edge. There's a bonus. There's a premium that goes to Olver. It's a consequence of being an incumbent. But incumbency advantage is not studied much or dwelt on much in the study of presidential elections. Maybe it should be. I think maybe obviously it should be, but it's not. There's been some recent work by some scholars giving some attention to it, for example, finding on average over the last century that in American presidential elections, incumbents do about 6% better than would plausible counterfactual candidates. Leave that blank for the moment. There's also cross-national studies. There's a good cross-national study by a political scientist at Minnesota. So, no, awful lot of presidential systems. You get a premium. You get 6 or 8 points for being an incumbent, running again, controlling for all else. Okay. Incumbency advantage. What is it? By convention, let me make it clear what I'm going to be talking about here. By convention, incumbency advantage means the person rather than the party. I mean, we could have a little bit of confusion here. It means the person. Incumbency advantage means over. It doesn't mean Democrats in the first district. It means Bush in 2004, Bush the son. It doesn't mean Republicans in 2004. In the study of Congress, it's individuals we dwell on when we talk about incumbency advantage, and that's entirely my meaning here. In the next 40 minutes or so, or 30, however long I rattle on. That having been said, incumbency advantage beyond that can have two distinct meanings. The first is as a statistical pattern. That's what I'm going to be dwelling on mostly here. A statistical pattern. What I mean by that is that incumbent candidates tend to run better in elections, or to win more often, than do non-incumbent candidates through some plausible counterfactual construction of or non-incumbent candidates, or for that matter, cross-sectional. A statistical pattern. As a statistical matter, whatever may explain the statistical pattern, there just will be a statistical pattern that your incumbent candidates will win more often and probably win by get higher proportions of the votes. All right, that'll be the center of my analysis as I go on, but I want to swerve beyond the confusion that might result by not stating to you at the start that incumbency advantage can mean something somewhat different. That is to say, it can mean an explanation of the statistical pattern of incumbency advantage. You might say, oh, well, the reason that incumbents win by a whole lot is because they can raise more campaign money. That would be an explanation, incumbency advantage explanation of the statistical pattern of incumbency advantage. But I want to dwell, as I say, on the statistical pattern. That is, a statistical matter, incumbents tend to run better. That's what I'm doing. All right. Now, the shtick for me tonight is historical extensiveness. This is a history excavation I'm trafficking in here. I want to go all the way back to 1788. Starting in 1788, when George Washington rode into the White House, well, it wasn't built yet, but figuratively rode into the White House on his horse, more or less. Starting in 1788, the USA has had 55 presidential elections. Or perhaps we should say selection events, since I'm not sure we'd want to call 1788 actually an election. Let's say selection events, but for short we'll say elections. Let's say 55 presidential elections. That's quite a lot. It's not 1,000. If you're doing statistics, you'd rather have 1,000 rather than 55, but you'd still rather have 55 rather than 6, let's say, in dealing with units. So we've had 55 elections. Now, it's unconventional to look back all the way to 1788, as I'm going to do tonight. Generally speaking, historians and political scientists, they leave out the early elections. They more or less imply that the early elections, like the first couple of generations of American history, that the history then took place on another planet, sort of. That is, it's. I think that's a mistake. We get transfixed by the mass election returns that kicked in the 1830s. That's our statistics, generally speaking, for the vote in presidential elections start in the 1830s or maybe in 1828 with when Jackson came to the White House. But before that, all the way back to 1788, it was a very open politics in the U.S. The potential for mobilization in the presidential elections, presidential selection events, was there. Ron Chernow's recent biography of Alexander Hamilton, for example, he has this wonderful picture of Alexander Hamilton, the 1800 presidential. He wasn't running, but he was trying to get the Federalists to stay in office, even though he hated Adams. Has a picture of Alexander Hamilton campaigning one-on-one, just buttonholing people, if they had buttonholes back then, on the streets of Manhattan, saying, please vote for the Federalist candidate to the state legislature, so that the state legislature will choose the electors that will help keep the Federalist Party in control of the White House. This is really intense politics. Alexander Hamilton doing it. This is an open, contested politics. To put a little bit of statistical flesh on it, in the first dozen American presidential elections, that's 1788 through 1832, the first 12 presidential elections, there were probably, it's reasonable to say, four squeakers. Those narrow results, 1796, Adams wins, 1800, Jefferson wins. 1824 is a mess. 1812 is pretty close to a speaker when Hamilton. There are two incumbent losses during those first 12 elections, both Adams, father and son, lost the presidency successfully in 1800 and 1832, they did. In the lifetimes of many of us, not most of you, but many of us in the room, the median is less than this in the room, the last dozen presidential elections, there have been five squeakers and three incumbent losses. So the four versus the two in the very early days is not much different from the five versus the three. In memorable times, the five squeakers we've had, Kennedy in 1960, Nixon in 68, Carter in 76, I guess you'd want to say, and certainly, Bush in 2000, and Bush again in 2004, that's pretty close to a squeaker. And there have been three incumbent losses. Ford lost in 76, Ford, the appointed president, the only one ever to get there, not through getting elected, at least as a VP, lost in 76 to Carter, and then Carter loses in 80, and then Bush the father loses in 1992. So it was an open politics early on. There's some reason, going back to 1788, Sam Huntington's got a nice point somewhere, that an interesting thing about the USA is that some of its oldest institutions are its political institutions, including its political practices, as on Capitol Hill and the candidates and so forth and so forth. All right. Now, you might say, taking over, that's 55 elections starting in 1788, you might say, oh, well, shouldn't we look at subsets of that sequence of 55? Are we missing something by choosing, you know, this era, that era, or that era? It's possible we're missing something, but I'm going to bypass that today. I think that you can get mesmerized by small numbers. You get six doing this and eight doing that. I'd like to take the generality of it and just play some numbers games with the 55 tonight. You really can't get misled by small numbers. I mean, you might say, oh, isn't North Dakota a Democratic state? They've had two Democrats in the Senate seemingly forever. No. Most electoral outcomes in North Dakota would not yield Democrats in the Senate. It's kind of an illusion. It's a small numbers illusion. All right, take the 55. The 55, can you see me back there still okay in the back? Is it okay? Is it all right? The 55 presidential elections. I'm going to break this into, first for openers, into a dichotomy. In 31 cases of these presidential elections or selection events, an incumbent was running again. That is, somebody already in the White House was running again and was being on the ballot again to try to stay in the White House. 31. And in 24 instances, that's not the case. The 24 instances, let's call them open seat elections, to use the terminology that's commonly used in talking about congressional elections, is 31 versus 24. Again, the numbers are getting small now, so we can get distrustful of what we can infer from them, but there we are. It's still better than half a dozen. Now, there are a couple of sub-universes here, in short, or universes, the 21 incumbent head elections and the 24 open seat elections. Now, I see a couple of differences in patterns between the, and hence I'm going to get pretty quickly here into table one and table two. Table one, between the incumbent held set and the open seat set of the presidential election. The first one, go to table one. It is this. It's not surprising, but it's true as well as not surprising. It's that the incumbents, the elections with the incumbents running again, they tend to be closer. I mean, it's not surprising, but there it is. They tend to be closer. Table one, I got to do a little bit of explanation of that. At the top, it says it's organized across the top in the category 0 to 4.9% and so forth into the popular vote edges in presidential elections. Popular vote edges. That's the winner's percent. I'm defining that as the winner's percent of the total vote minus the runner-up's percentage of the total vote. For example, in 2004, that would be about 2%. As Bush is about 51% and Kerry's about 49%. With change, it would be about a 2% winner's percent edge in the popular vote in 2004. That's where we are. It's runner-up. That can mean that some oddity can sneak in, as in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt, the third-party candidate, was the runner-up rather than the incumbent William Howard Taft. So we put Wilson against T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, in 1912 for purposes of this chart. That's just a small footnote-y kind of thing. Now, there's a tricky question of who's the winner of a presidential election. And in this talk, although I should say that to help grease along what I'm doing, is that if I made a different move here, the results would not differ significantly in what I'm saying. But I'm defining the winner of the presidency as the party who actually end up occupying the White House. Now, that's a bit of an embarrassment in some junctures of American history where the party that takes the White House, or the candidate who takes the White House, is representing a party, runs a little bit behind the the other candidate. There are four and possibly five instances of this in American history. In 1824, Adams got the White House, although he had fewer popular votes than Jackson, you may remember. 1876, Hayes got the White House with fewer popular votes than Tilden for the workings of the Electoral College. 1888, Benjamin Harrison got it that way over Cleveland, same thing. And in 2000, as we all remember, Bush got the White House with about 500,000 popular votes, fewer than Gore got. There's also the interesting instance of 1960, which is not often talked about. In 1960, that's your Kennedy-Nixon election. The canonical presentation of the popular vote result, that is, that Kennedy was ahead in 1960 in the popular vote nationally by about 100,000, but there are very respectable ways of counting the popular vote in 1960 that give an edge to Nixon nationwide in the popular vote. And it's becoming an increasing theme in the electoral history scholarship that's true, that makes a lot of sense. And it has nothing to do with corruption in Chicago, where thousands of votes were stolen in 1960, but rather with how to deal with the curious matter of the Alabama vote in 1960, which I won't get into. But in a nutshell, it's that the Alabama voters voted for electors rather than for Kennedy or Nixon. They had no chance to vote for Kennedy or Nixon or anybody else. And there's a very strange business wherein the Kennedy showing in the popular vote in Alabama was really not all that great. I won't go into the details. And there's a very quite nice way of counting the popular vote in Alabama in 1960 that putting Alabama in the pot, in the whole country pot, gives a little bit of a popular vote edge nationally to Nixon in 1960. Now, in the American system, it's really not terribly important who gets a plurality of the popular vote nationally, because you don't get the White House that way. So there's a fair amount of diciness strewn back there across the generations in the counting of the popular vote. For example, in 1880, Garfield is said to have won the national popular vote with an edge of 8,000 votes, and Lord knows. I mean, corruption alone in 20 or 30 states could have turned that. We may never know who actually did get a popular vote edge in 1880, given the reported edge of only 8,000 votes nationally for one candidate. But we don't have to know that. Anyway, what I'm doing, the winner is the party or the candidate who actually ends up occupying the White House like Bush in 2001. Now, in the very early elections through the 1820s, there is not a popular vote that's even worth counting. The president is chosen. The electoral votes in the states are chosen by the state legislatures in most states during that time, and so we don't have popular vote totals that are worth a whole lot nationally until the 1820s, so what am I doing here? Well, for purposes of making up a chart, what I did was to impute backwards the likely split in the popular vote for these earlier elections by seeing what, in the last century and a half of American history, the electoral vote split amounts to in a relation to the popular vote split in various elections. You see, I mean, if you get a close electoral vote, then you could, by looking at the last 150 years, you can see what the relation is between electoral vote split and popular vote split. Then look at electoral vote split for the first couple of generations up through the 1820s and impute a possible or probable or something like that popular vote split. This doesn't need to be exact. I'm just operating within a five-point category here, so it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I should say also that the early elections don't swerve my results. In fact, the results are even a little bit statistically leaving out the elections before the 1830s, but I think it's kind of neat to put in elections all the way back for display purposes, and I like these early elections, so I'm doing it. Now, table number one, at the top, we've got elections with incumbent candidates running again, and as you see, they tend not to be so close. The distribution is fairly even across the page, with a lot of elections there with incumbents running being won by over 20%. George Washington in 1792, he's still, there's the aura in Monroe and Coolidge and Franklin Roosevelt second time, and Lyndon Johnson and Nixon are over the 20% edge there, you see. And it's a lot of them win by a lot. Now, it is true that you can lose a lot. And incumbents sometimes lose, and sometimes they lose big. And you can see at the top of my chart are the instances where incumbents lost. The instances where incumbents lost are the ones that are underlined. And I don't give you here the incumbents who lost, but rather the challengers who beat them. So you look to the northeast corner of the chart, F.D. Roosevelt underlined. That means he beat Hoover in 1932. But to go back a bit, Andrew Jackson beat Adams in 1828. These are pretty big victories by non-incumbents. I think that the lesson off this is that being an incumbent gives you a leg up. It gives you an opportunity to be a big noise success as a politician, but you can blow it. Or else bad stuff can come along like the Depression and blow it for you in Hoover's case. But I do think it's possible just to blow it. I have the sense that not just in the American presidential election and presidency world, but in all over the world, that chief executives are watched very closely. And for the most part, they succeed. You got the job, probably you'll keep it. But they're watched very closely. Every day, all the time, chief executives are watched. You could blow it. For example, Gray Davis, the governor of California, they just took him out with a hook after he served a little bit, you remember, in that recall election. Howell Raines, the head of the New York Times, they took him out with a hook a few years ago. The recent prime minister of Japan lasted just a few months. Abe, he came in with a halo around him. The halo was on the floor after about 6 months, and he resigned, just gave up the premiership. These things can happen. It happens to university presidents and to even to monarchs sometimes. I'm sure not here. It happens at Yale, but not. It did happen at Yale. You remember that. It happened at Yale. It did. You could blow it. It's very important. These are very important people, chief executives, and they're closely watched. And they can. There you are. So you can blow it, like Adams at 1828 and William Howard Taft in 1912, who shows up with the underlined Wilson in the middle of the top of the chart here. All right, you go to the bottom though. The open seat elections. I'm still on table one. These ones tend to be close. See, you take out the incumbent, and the results cluster in the 0 to 5% category, some of them being a little bit minus, as they say, because sometimes the winner comes up a little short, and so this accommodates minus signs that are next to figures of trivial magnitude, a few of them. In the bottom, it's even interesting to look and see in the bottom of table one when it's been true that presidential candidates have won elections by a lot. In open seat circumstances, it's very exceptional to do that. You see, this is the southeast part of the chart, table one. George Washington in 1788. Now, there's an open seat election. There wasn't any incumbent going into 1788. And Washington won it unanimously, riding in on his horse. That's an instance of a great big victory in an open seat circumstance. Right under him is Warren Harding in 1920. This is after World War I. And I think the lesson there is that the conducting of World War I under Wilson and its aftermath in 1920, which is extraordinarily destructive for the Democrats. To be associated with that war and what happened afterward just put them out. It became possible for a Republican to win in an open seat election by 20 points. Well, this is the biggest Republican victory in American history in 1920. Harding, bad president too, but there it was. And just to the left of that is Hoover in 1928. See, there's an open seat election. Coolidge retired. Hoover wins by a lot. There you get the Al Smith Catholic candidacy, which probably depressed the Democratic vote more than it ordinarily would have gotten depressed in 1928, although I suspect it may be a hangover even still then in 1928 from World War I. I think it took the Democrats maybe three elections to recover from their alleged or perceived ignominious performance in the teens in the war and then the war aftermath, because they did dismally in 1920, 1924, and 1928. There you are. So much for that. That's my first pattern. Now, on to table two. And this is my, take a breath, without a particularly deep breath, but a breath. My table two. It takes the 55 presidential elections. I'm going to strip it down to, for a moment, I'm going to tell you what I do with it. This is the question. Here I'm asking the question, has the party that's got the presidency, this is looking at here, as party, as incumbent in a sense, although I said I wouldn't do that, has the party that's got the presidency, does the party that's got the presidency keep it? More often, when it runs an incumbent on the ballot, metaphorically, there was not a ballot in 1792, but you know what I mean, does the party keep it more often when it runs an incumbent than when the party in control of the White House has to withstand an open seat election? That's where we are in table number two here. Now, to do this table, the answer is yes, you can see from the table. But let me say, to do this chart, I had to shrink my 55 down to 53. This is a trivial point, but I'll voice it. In 1788, you can't ask this question because there's no party possessing the presidency going into the 1788 presidential election. And you can't ask it really very meaningfully about the 1824 election, which you may remember. That's when the Federalists had collapsed, they went belly up, and every candidate in 1824 was of the same party, just trying to succeed Monroe. So you really can't ask that question meaningfully or usefully, but that takes it down to 53. That's a small point. Now, this is my exhibit A. My table two it's a very simple, interesting, I hope it's an interesting point, it's a very simple point in table two. And the answer is yes. That is the and if notice that the Running an incumbent again, the party running an incumbent again, that includes incumbents in all circumstances. It includes Franklin Roosevelt three times. He was running an incumbent in 1936, 1940, and 1944. It includes your incumbents who got there through succession, for vice presidential succession. It includes Coolidge, it includes Harry Truman, it includes Teddy Roosevelt, it includes Lyndon Johnson. They all got there because presidents died. And it includes Jerry Ford, who got there because Nixon went back on his plane to California. But they're running as incumbents again, are these people, in the succeeding election. So they've got the office running again, Truman in 1948, Teddy Roosevelt in 1904. That's the break I'm making. Is there incumbent on the ballot or isn't there? Now, the pattern is at the top, the pattern is that when the party runs an incumbent, the party keeps the presidency two-thirds of the time, or rather 21 to 10. This is a nicer number. When I first did this exercise, it was back in 2003, before the 2004 election, and the pattern was 20 to 10 at the top and 11 to 11 at the bottom, which are Pythagorean in their simplicity as numbers. So the reality got messed up a bit by Bush winning again in 2004, 21 to 10 as opposed to 21 to 10 as opposed to 11 to 11 at the bottom. So basically what you're seeing here again is that the party that's got the presidency keeps it two-thirds of the time if it runs a human being who's already in the office. And when it doesn't run a human being who's already in the office, it's a flat-foot tie. It's 11 to 11. Now, this is a fact. It's a fact. Thus organized, it's a fact. It's a somewhat small numbers fact. It's not 1,000. There we are. But it's all the fact we've got. We can't coin presidential elections another 500 to play games with them. After another century of American history, maybe we have 85 instances or something if the country goes on. You could do some of this sort of thing with governors, and maybe that would work. I think actually maybe it would. I would guess maybe if you did the thing with American governors, you'd come up with something like the same result, though I haven't seen it done. But it's there. Now, as a statistical matter, if you run a statistical test here and ask, well, is there really statistically a significant difference between the top of the table two we're looking at, between the pattern of 21 to 10 and 11 to 11 at the bottom? Well, it's a bit dicey. The answer is, according to my graduate students who did this for me, the odds are about 9 out of 10 that this relation is not a fluke. The odds are only about 1 in 10 that it is a fluke. We'd like to have a little better than that. It's nice to have 1 out of 20 or 1 out of 100 or something, but that's where the statistics come down, it's not there. There we are. Okay, now, so to hark back to the elections that you people can remember, that the students can remember, they map very nicely onto your memories. That is the 2000 election. The whole business flashes back to 50-50. It's hard to imagine a closer election in 2000 than the Gore-Bush election, and one party takes it by kind of luck. If it had been held 2 days later, it might have gone another way. 2 days earlier, it might have gone. That sort of a thing. It was that close of an election in 2000. Flashes back to 50-50. The other party takes it. 2004, well, the incumbent keeps it. Not really much of a surprise, although it could have gone the other way. After all, Bush's father lost in 1992. I'm not trying to make something deterministic here, but nonetheless, the facts. The recent history jives with it for what that's worth. And what we're seeing in 2008, I mean, the best prediction, knowing nothing else, for 2008 is that we'll get a close election and nobody can tell who's going to win it. And that's about where we are. Now, when you get into an election season, obviously contextual information becomes important. Rather than historical generalizations, it's sort of like the difference between the Weather Channel and the Farmer's Almanac if you can to figure out whether to put your overshoes on. You're better to go with the current situation as reported out there than with what's happened on January 23rd for the last 200 years. It's that kind of a thing. Of course, that's true. Now, I want to put a footnote in here, which people sometimes ask me, how about vice presidents? Suppose a party runs an incumbent vice president for the presidency, okay, like Al Gore in 2000? What does that do for you? Well, I mean, statistically, not much can be done with this, but the interesting question was whether a party benefits from an incumbency advantage thing by running its VP who's trying to move up, like Al Gore in 2000. I think the answer is no. I mean, there are seven instances in American history where a VP tried to move up. There are six instances where a VP of a regnant party tried to move up. In three cases they made it, three cases they lost. And John Adams made it in 1796 as a Federalist, and Martin Van Buren made it in 1836 as a Democrat, and George Bush the father made it in 1988 as a Republican. But Nixon lost it in 1960 as a Republican, and Humphrey lost it in 1968 as a Democrat, and Al Gore lost it, sort of, by my definition of winner, in 2000. So it's 3-3. The seventh instance is Thomas Jefferson in the very odd circumstance of moving up to the presidency in 1800 under the old electoral system, wherein he could run as VP, as incumbent VP, against his own incumbent P. That is the presidency, back when you could have a vice president of one party and a president of the other party. So let's forget about Jefferson at that time. I think also the logic of it is not with the idea that, or the proposition, that you get some incumbency advantage kick out of running your VP who's trying to move up. I don't think second banana sells very well. I mean, having been second banana for 4 years and being seen to be that, it just doesn't do you a whole lot of good. You could get, to use a different metaphor, you get overshadowed or even toyed with by your president often. I mean, it was really good for Nixon to have Eisenhower say bad things about him in 1960, or for Hubert Humphrey to have President Lyndon Johnson make him look like a fool in 1968, probably not. You remember Al Gore's problem trying to get around Bill Clinton in 2000. It probably doesn't help. So I would guess we can just leave out of the conversation any party advantage deriving from running a VP who's trying to move up. All right, take a breath. Now there's a place for a breath here. This is a real breath here, because I'm going to go on to I've done with table one and table two, because I want to switch gears here and ask this, and this is entirely speculative, this what I'm going to do here in this part. If there is this pattern of statistical advantage where the party running an incumbent does better, you know, 2-1, the 2-1 versus the 1-1, that is, then why? What reasons might we come up with whereby we could explain why this might be true, if it is true? A lot of this is common sense, and let's move to table three, which is a recitation largely of common sense I put here. Let me say that it would be nice if I could do something more than speculate, but I can't. And even in the study of congressional elections, where we have 435 House members running all the time, and where incumbency advantage in elections has been a life topic for 40 years or 30 years, something like that, there's still an awful lot of disputation about exactly what it is about incumbency advantage, or what explains the statistical pattern of incumbency advantage, put it that way. So it's just not easy to know these things. So there we are with speculation. Okay. Now, an issue here, as I'm purveying or trafficking in possible explanations, again, is the matter of the statistical pattern, that is the two-thirds pattern as opposed to the 50-50 pattern. It's the difference between the statistical displays here. All right, number one on the chart, this is very commonsensical. It's that your incumbent candidate, you get an incumbent candidate as a consequence of the incumbent holding the office. That is, there's some sort of benefits or something like that that accrue from being in the White House. And they might acquire skills. Maybe you get better at it. I mean, Clinton probably got to be a better politician, for example, between 1993 and 1996. Most people say so. It could be a matter of resources. For example, incumbents running again seldom have any difficulty raising campaign money. They can just go out there and pick it off the trees if they're running again. It tends to go with the office. You can put together an organization in office. The Clintons have still got their own organization. It doesn't seem to be doing too well. The wheels are falling off, but they still got their organization from having held the White House for 8 years. It's still there. Then there are presidential prerogatives I've got here. That is, the president can make speeches at a relevant time that are feel good or demonstrative or something like that. The president can make flashy appointments. I'm going to mention some in 1940 a little bit downstream here. The president can make diplomatic moves that can be politically helpful. The president can fire off cruise missiles at relevant times, as Clinton once did. Bush in 2004, Bush, after the hurricane in Florida, he was down there personally handing out ice to people after the Florida hurricane. President Bush was doing that. It's difficult for Kerry to do that, see? I mean, Kerry is, I mean, he doesn't have the office. He's not running FEMA. So it makes less sense for Bush to Kerry to pass out the ice. Bush was doing it. The last phrase here under this heading is a little spooky. Valence issue positioning. It's an argument made recently by some political scientists. The argument here is this, that the man in the presidency, the person in the presidency, it's been all men so far, doesn't have to run so much on issues, but rather can run on performance and managerial success and all that. The economy's going well, maybe. Whereas the challenger candidate can't do that. The challenger candidate is sort of reduced to running on issue positions, and to run on issue positions more than does an incumbent, the ideological issue positions, puts you at a bit of a disadvantage because it might separate you from the median voter more than would be the case if you're running on how nice things are, because I've been running the country for 4 years, that sort of thing. Maybe that's true. Anyway, this is speculation. The second item on the chart deserves about a sentence. It's important, but it can just be stated. There's, there might be an edge, an incumbent candidacy edge, do it running previous campaigns. You got the experience. You know how to do it. The other person may not have experience. The third, I think, is really quite important, although nobody knows. It's an incumbent candidacy edge that could derive from voter attitudes, and probably from voter attitudes of a kind that might apply especially to holders of the presidential office or candidates, therefore. One is that voters might be risk-averse. Notice that the president, this is only in the last half century, but before that there are some things that are there, not quite equivalent, but they're there. Only the president can fire off, he's got a finger on the nuclear button. There's anything you know about the last 4 years is that nobody's fired off, nobody pressed the nuclear button. That puts it in a nutshell. That is, somehow the civilization has survived during the last 4 years. If this is the devil you know, it may just be better on odds than the devil you don't. There's a certain unknown quality to challengers where, and could, to be sure, you might just hate your incumbent and throw him out. But nonetheless, it's there. But there also can be, this may belong under the same heading, but perhaps there's a distinct entry, perceived startup costs. As you put a new president in, it takes them 6 months to fill the jobs. You go 6 months and they still haven't appointed undersecretaries in the Defense Department, the way things operate. They can't get confirmed on the Hill. The president can't figure out whom to appoint. They've got to get them through vetting processes. The country sags for about 6 months when you get a new human being in the White House. The president may not know what to do, as is often canonically reported of Kennedy in 1961. He comes in and he veers himself into the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961, which is a stupid thing to do, and probably Eisenhower wouldn't have done it. And there it was. New presidents sometimes do things like that. It might also be under voter inertia that, I read a recent paper that makes this case, that voters get stuck in their own decisions. I mean, they voted for somebody and they get stuck into defending what they did 4 years ago. And they may say, they talk themselves into thinking that since they voted for X, then X must have been a good president, so let's vote for him again. That's sort of the logic. Maybe that's there. All right, number four. This is, let's call it, innately superior talents. Okay, now this is an interesting argument made by particularly John Zoller, the political scientist at UCLA recently. It's this, that people who make it to the presidency through election are more talented than people who are challenged them or didn't make it. It's sort of like why did Mike Tyson win most of his fights? He's a better fighter than most people he faced. Now, with presidents who won the last election and are running again, one thing you know about that winner of the last election who's got the White House is that he beat a Class A candidate last time. I mean, the candidate of the other party is the best candidate probably the party could put up last time. So people who beat a Class A candidate last time are probably premium politicians within their contest class, put it that way. Premium politicians within their contest class. And there's a model that's been written recently by Chris Aiken at Princeton, which plays this, makes a formal model out of this and predicts with some plausible assumptions that indeed you would expect a two-thirds result with incumbents given some suitable assumptions of this sort. Incumbents running again probably two-thirds of the time would make it. All right, my fifth category, and I'm rounding toward a close here, is strategic behavior. This is something you want to take into account. And notice what I'm trying to do here again is to explain the pattern of 2-to-1, it's a statistical difference, as opposed to the pattern of 1-to-1 at the bottom. And we got to think about fishy things that might be going on, or possibly fishy things, or things that could be thought about as fishy things that could be going on that could help to explain that pattern of the 2-to-1 versus the 1-to-1 at the bottom. Okay, strategic behavior. Now, strategic behavior, it could take place in theory in the out party. Now, I want to make this intuitive. And at the level of congressional elections, we know very well that sometimes the out party puts up a weak candidate against an incumbent. They don't think they can take the seat, so they put their money, the national party puts its money into other seats. And sometimes, it's probably true, that sometimes an incumbent keeps a House seat because the other party put up a weak candidate, or didn't even put up a candidate at all. We see that. We can make a list where that's probably the case. In the 2006 election, the Democrats kicked themselves in the tail after the election by waiting. We put another $50,000 into these five races and we'd have five more House seats. The candidates were not good enough. We didn't fund them well enough. Maybe we should have chosen better candidates in some seats they didn't have good, so forth and so forth. And the case for strategic behavior, that is to say in the out party, among by the party or by people who might have been candidates and who were not is often posed in an argument for the success of incumbents, but in percentages, percentage of the vote, but also sometimes in just keeping winning the seats or not winning the seats. It's a very plausible account sometimes at the level of U.S. House elections. I think it's less plausible at the level of U.S. Senate elections. All right. Now, however, so in short, if the out party wimps out, that helps the ins. And so if the out party always puts up weak candidates against incumbents, then your incumbents are probably going to win. There's no big surprise. All right, on to table four. But does that happen at the level, that sort of thing happen at the level of presidential elections? And I think the answer is no. That is, the out party, that's the party not possessing the White House when incumbent is running again to try to keep it, does not really put up weak candidates. And the presidency is too important for that. The elections are too close for that. I mean, it's rare that the other party trying to take the presidency is just playing counted out early in the game. There's hope. The politicians, they see if they're ever going to make it, they got to try this time. You can't wait 4 years. That isn't the way life operates. So they contest for it. Now, you might say there are instances where a party that didn't think they could win it didn't put up its Class A candidates, put up people from Team B rather than Team A. And sometimes the 1992 election is talked about that way. That's the one where Clinton ran and beat Bush the father. And one story about that election, well, Clinton got the nomination because the really good candidates, as Cuomo and Gore and somebody else, wouldn't run. But that's kind of a stupid story. I mean, Clinton was a better candidate than these chaps. Clinton was more committed, a better speaker. He's really not a Class B candidate. I mean, his testimony to his Class A-ness that he did it and won it. So I don't think so. If you look down the list, I invite you to take this list home and look at it and ask yourself whether consulting your history, that the challengers to incumbent candidates on the left are weaker than the ones on the right, where the out party is trying to win the presidency in an open seat election. I think the answer is no. I mean, the presidential elections are too important. So I don't see the out party wimping out to the favor of the ends. So strategic behavior by the out party or possible candidates therein probably will not help me to explain this 2-to-1 at the top versus 1-to-1 at the bottom disparity I'm talking about here. All right, let's switch to strategic behavior by the in party. This is probably more interesting and promising. And the idea here is this, that, and let's switch to table 5, which I'm going to explicate for you. There could be a kind of reverse causation going on here. That is to say, it might not be that incumbency advantage causes victories again, but rather the perceived imminence of defeat causes non-incumbencies. That is to say, if put it this way, if it, a couple of things can happen. If the party's got a weak incumbent, the party can yank the incumbent and run somebody else, in which case you don't have an incumbent running again. But more interestingly, an incumbent can fold. That is, an incumbent who looks like facing a bad election, I just got a man, I make it this time, can retire, go back to the ranch, go back to Crawford or whatever, back in Texas. Now, let's call this the Senator Tribble effect. This Senator Tribble was a senator from Virginia in the night, whenever it was, the 1980s, was it Adley, something like that. He was a one-term senator, Republican, and he's about a young person, and a reasonably successful senator. One supposed that he could spend 50 years in the Senate or 40 or something like that, but he's considering running again for re-election after one term, and he's coming up against this very popular Virginia governor then, very popular Chuck Robb at that time, and everybody said, Tribble's got no chance against this incumbent governor, Democrat, is going to run against him. Tribble read those stories too, and he retired. He said, retiring is better than losing, so why not do that? You could also call this the King Leopold effect. That is, in 1940, King Leopold of the Belgians, he surrendered rather than lose to the Germans. That's a good way not to lose, to surrender. Now, if incumbents who faced defeat all the time folded, then you see you would not get incumbents losing ever. There'd be kind of fishiness to the fact that incumbents don't lose. You'd find Herbert Hoover folding rather than running again in 1932. You'd find William Howard Taft, whose polls must have been terrible if any was could have contrived how to take them in 1912, folding in 1912 rather than running again. If incumbents only wanted to run again, had perfect knowledge, and always pulled out when they thought they were going to lose, why then the incumbents, you'd never find any incumbents losing. This could be a strategic, you see this, an strategic behavior thing kind of thing going on. All right, switch to table 5. I'm going to test that a little bit with some little bit of numbers. This is a subuniverse of 30 instances. This gets a little complicated, but it's got a point. This is table 5. I picked out 30 instances where you would especially expect an incumbent president to run again, right? And in a propitious circumstances for an incumbent president running again. And here's what I looked at. This is a very familiar kind of thing. I looked at presidents who'd gotten elected once previously, sort of like Bush in 2004 deciding whether to run again. He's elected once, he's the winner anyway, in 2000, trying to figure out in 2004 whether to run again. Clinton in 1996 is trying to figure out whether to run again. He's won once previously. That means not zero. So I'm throwing out of the data set your vice presidential succeeders like Ford or somebody who had won before. Just, let's get rid of them here and just look at the people who won once before. And I want to throw out of this data set your presidents who had won more than once. That is Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, in his second, his third and fourth incarnations get heaved out of this chart. I'm just looking at the first termers who are considering whether to become second termers, all right? And there are 30 instances, and I included in the 30 instances a couple of presidents that, who had served 5 years rather than four coming up to the choice whether to run again because they inherited the presidency through a presidential death with only 1 year left on a term. That's Calvin Coolidge got the presidency through a death in 1923, won it in 24, and then decided again in 1928 whether to run again. And Coolidge ranked for me as a first termer. He was seen as a first termer trying to run again if he wanted to do it in 1928. It's also true with Lyndon Johnson in 1968. He got the presidency through death in 1963 and then won it in 64, and he's seen as a first termer coming into 1968. It'll be only natural for old Lyndon to run again in 1968. It's the American custom for presidents who had won once before and served one term to run again. But I throw out a couple of presidents who served almost two full terms, although they got the first one through death. That's Teddy Roosevelt, and very early. He had served 7.5 years, roughly, by the time he came up to 1908. And Harry Truman had served more than 7.5 years, 1940 and 1952, when he had to figure whether to run again. They just go out of the chart. This is kind of complicated, but I hope you see the principle. All right, there are 30 instances. In those 30 instances, 24 of them ran again and 6 didn't. This is my table 5. The ones who didn't run again are underlined, and let's take a look at those folks. Pierce, his party yanked him. He looked like a weakie, and they took him out, and ran Buchanan, who won by a big percentage anyway for the Democrats in 1856, and it's hard to know what to do with that. Hayes and Polk, they both promised at the time they got their nominations in the first place for not to run again. It was a condition of nomination at early time that they promised they wouldn't run again. It was thought to be the nice thing to do. They promised to be a one-termer, sort of self-terminal and limiting from day one. And they stuck by their promise. Buchanan was, he was an old-timer by the time he got there, and it's true that the country and his party was crashing around him in 1859-60. This was before the Civil War, and he presided over the messiness of the late 1850s, and Lincoln did take the election in 1860. He didn't run again. All right, I've organized this chart by way of what amounts to a kind of unobtrusive variable, keying on how long these folks survived after they made the decision whether to run or not again at the ends of their first terms. It's you see that survival in years beyond the end of the first term. Herbert Hoover went on indestructibly for 31 years after he left the presidency in 1932. Just indomitable was Hoover. I remember him when I was a kid. He couldn't get rid of him. It's the and what else? Who else is that? John Adams lived for a long time, as we know. All right. Now the interesting cases are Johnson and Coolidge. Now, Johnson and Coolidge in 1928, again, he was seen to be a first-termer, could have run again. People thought everybody said he would have won again if he'd run again in 28. But I've read the histories about Coolidge, and both he and his wife thought he was in real health trouble. And in fact, he died a little less than 4 years later. It was a cardiac problem, and he was struggling. People didn't know this, except his family. Even his doctors were confused. But looking back at it now, he and his wife were getting messages that the guy was in trouble. So he went back to wherever it was, maybe to Amherst. Where did Coolidge come back to? There he was. He just left and didn't live too long. Now, Lyndon Johnson is a mixed case. The canonical view, and it has an awful lot of truth to it in Johnson's case, is that he pulled out in 1968 because his polls were bad and because the war was going badly, and that's certainly true. But you've got to be a little careful. It's a kind of ideological narrative. You always have to be careful of them. It's additionally true that he was dying. And he thought he was dying pretty quickly. And in fact, he was right. His health was terrible in 1968. I've read histories of this. He did a self-study of his health in 1967. And his doctor said, well, maybe another 4.5 years and that's it. And in fact, he after he did leave the presidency in 1968, he had a bad cardiac arrest in 1970, and by 1972, he was just completely disabled, and he died about 4 years later. He probably would not have survived another 4 years in the presidency, and he knew that. So his pullout is at least doubly determined. Okay, doubly determined. All right, the bottom line out of this chart, I think, is that there's not an awful lot for the idea of strategic behavior by incumbents pulling out because they think they're going to lose. Maybe there's a little bit of it, and it partly explains the Johnson case. It partly explains the Buchanan case, and we've got to take another look at the Truman case, but that's the extent of the degree to which I think that the strategic behavior by pulling out by incumbents, you see, if I'm going to lose, the King Leopold effect. Yeah, that's probably the limit of the force of that account of what might be going on. All right, so I don't think there's an awful lot in it. I think mostly the explanation for the 2-to-1, back to my table 2, lies in the first four categories here, and I don't know how to choose among them. I think that, you know, the benefits of office, the you ran again last time, voter risk aversion and such, the prize fighter's argument, that is the innate talent. I think some combination of categories 1, 2, 4 probably look like giving us the bulk of the truth. I'm rounding to an end here, by the way. In fact, I take another breath. Last section is implications. A couple of implications from this display. One of them is historical, that is appraising the past and thinking about it, not without relevance for today. The other one is more directly about the generality, but also including today. The first one is this, that It's neat. I think with this idea of incumbency advantage having probably the effect that it does, statistically and through its various explanations, with that in mind, those alleged rock-solid party eras of the past, they kind of look like candy, or crumbly candy, rather than rock-solid mountainous. Let me serve up this factoid. There are only three times in American history when a party has run an incumbent candidate more than twice in a row. There are three times in American history when a party has managed to run an incumbent candidate more than once in a row. Now, I'm assuming that it's very nice for a party to run an incumbent candidate. On average, it helps if you're able to run an incumbent candidate rather than suffer an open seat election. Only three times, again, has a party run an incumbent candidate more than once in a row. The last of those times is not an advertisement for my case. It's in 1972, Nixon ran as a Republican incumbent, and then in 1976, Ford ran as an Republican incumbent. You see, Ford, who succeeded when Nixon got onto his plane. That's two instances in a row where one party runs an incumbent, two instances in a row. Now, that's not before Ford lost in 76. Another week and he would have won, maybe, but still he lost in 1976. That's not an advertisement for my case. But you look backwards. The other instances are, first of all, 1900 and 1904. I mean, McKinley ran as a Republican incumbent and won again in the year 1900. Then he died. He was shot. And Teddy Roosevelt came in and ran as a Republican incumbent in 1904. So twice in a row, there's a Republican incumbent on the ballot. That's the first time in American history when that had happened. I suspect that the Republicans lucked out by being able to run incumbents twice in a row in 1900 and in 1904. It's an inference from the evidence about the general advantage of running incumbent candidacies. Now, we look back at that McKinley era, which extends on, and I expect that this partly artifactual matter of the successive incumbency luckout by the Republicans in 1900 and 1904. Then, of course, the great Big Bang instance of successive incumbent candidacies by a party came with the Democrats four times in a row with Roosevelt and Truman. That is, Roosevelt runs an incumbent in 1936, Roosevelt in 1940, there's Roosevelt in 1944, and Truman in 1948, after Roosevelt dies in 1945. That's four instances in a row where the Democrats are running an incumbent candidate. Never happened before, it'll never happen again. After the enactment of the 22nd Amendment, well, some deaths might do it, and vice presidential move-ups, but you wouldn't want to bet on it. All right. Now, the instance of the Roosevelt-Truman elections is especially interesting, because we tend to look at that that era of Roosevelt and Truman as a kind of rock-solid Democratic New Deal, Fair Deal era. That's the way we code it. We say, oh, well, I mean, the Republicans were real weakies. We do nothing during that time. It was just the nature of the politics during that couple of, even that generation and a half. However, I think that if you look at that history more closely, the particulars attending to incumbency advantages jump out and bite you. Let me specify. In 1930, let's leave that. 1940. 1940 and 1944 and 1948 are crisis elections, with the president in the White House being basically a national security manager, 1940, 1944, and 1948. In 1940, Roosevelt was not leaning toward running again, put it that way, He was going to break the third-term tradition. He was not leaning toward running again. I think that's the best generalization from the biographical accounts. But then, in the spring of 1940, the Nazis invaded France. And this is the worst crisis for the American state. It's the worst crisis since the 1860s. The Germans marching through France and about to reduce Britain in August and September of 1940. It's a real threat to the U.S. that that's happening. In that circumstance, Roosevelt chooses to run again, and in May and June of 1940, exactly when France is folding, Roosevelt surges in the polls. And you get these polling results suggesting that voters appreciate that experience in office with the propensities that Roosevelt's exhibiting are just what's needed at the time. You follow the polling history through 1940, I've done this, and I think there's a very good case that the 1940 result was basically a foreign policy result. If it runs as a domestic election, it's a toss-up. If it runs without Roosevelt on the ticket, it's a toss-up. It's a national security victory, I think, probably, in 1940. 1944 is a war election. Roosevelt's dying. The man is reduced to 2 good hours a day of work, but things are going well. The team's going well. It's 6 months from D-Day. Why upset it? 1948 is looked upon, as this is Truman running again after he succeeded to the presidency, is looked on basically as a, you know, give him hell, Harry, whistle stop selection. Overlooked is the Berlin missile crisis. The Berlin airlift in 1948, which I remember those big planes taking off and going into Tempelhof and dropping off food and whatever in 1948. Truman was at the helm. The 1948 election came within the time span of the Berlin airlift, which he probably read about. This is when the Russians were threatened to take over Berlin, the Soviets and the Americans and British decided to feed and clothe and so forth Berlin through an airlift rather than let them do it. That was going on. This is a very scary juncture. People thought a war was coming. They thought the U.S. might be at war within a few weeks in late 1948. Truman was managing it well, was seen to be managing it well, and also peacefully. A war did not break out. And I would guess, although historians have not emphasized that the national security incumbency side of the 1940 election helped keep the Democrats on top. So there's three elections in a row, 40, 44, and 48, where probably the voter risk averseness, critical presidential moves and appointments at various times helped. The parading of experience at the helm, this commander-in-chief, helped keep the party in power. In short, I think to extend the New Deal era, and here's a phrase that just trips off the tongue, if all the words are part of one noun, the New Deal era, beyond roughly 1938 is to traffic in a very fragile construct. There's a good deal of artifactuality inhering in the continued possession of the presidency through management of national security crises. So you tweak a few contingencies in the 1940s, and we could be talking about an age of Dewey, or an age of Wilkie, rather than a New Deal era. Just a few contingencies. Now, to take it up to the present, or this decade, is a similar point. People are talking about Karl Rove, or the Republicans, building an era, a Republican era, that would go on for, well, a long time, not maybe not forever, but just for a long time. That's not the way things happen. It was never likely to happen. Not because Karl Rove is not a good politician. He's one of the best builders, probably, in the history of presidential politics. But you can't build that way. It doesn't work. I mean, 2004 is an incumbency election, and Bush gets over the helm again, and then things crumble in 2006, and they may crumble in 2008. That's not out of order. It's about average for what you'd expect. Not out of, not, not, not. It's about, that was the end of it. All right, the second implication is that, and I'm going to finish with this, there's a lot of change and freshness that inheres in the U.S. presidential election system. It's just not a stagnancy that sets in and goes on forever, as might be suggested, by the way, by the notion of party eras. Forget about party eras. What I'm saying here is not just true of open seat elections. You can get refreshments by beating incumbents, as in 1992 when Bush the father was beaten by Clinton. But particularly in open seat circumstances, you can get an awful lot of freshness and change out of the way this system works, as in 1952 with Eisenhower, for example, or 2008. We're seeing it now. There's a lot of freshness in the air in 2008, which could come from either side. That's it. I went on for about an hour. That's not too bad. Do we want to have queries? Do we want to do some of that? Or are they too tired?
Well, you already advertised there's a debate going.
That's true enough. That's true. Oops.
My
foot hurts now. Right. My leg hurts, right. Maybe they don't want to do that. Maybe they want to go see Obama and Glester. There's a lot of freshness on the Democratic side.
Well, just throw a couple of things in.
Yeah. I like this already.
Democrats were faced with hemorrhage from the Democratic
Party.
Yep. So that was going to happen. Henry Wallace left moving on.
Yep.
The reaction to the Cold War.
Yep.
And Strom Thurmond leading the Dixiecrats out. People thought that would really wreck the party, but instead of wrecking the party, it really strengthened the party.
Yep.
Because what pushed out the Henry Wallace people was a strong stand in the Cold War.
Yep.
That brought back the German and Italian Catholics who defected during the Second World War. And what pushed out the Dixiecrats with a strong stand on civil rights and the Truman administration, which was spurring up the support of blacks in the cities. So there was really still a lot more movement within that majority coalition. But then again, look, I don't think we can dispense with this entirely. Now, FDR laments the turn of the century that we're a party that can win only by accident. Because it's only TR running in 1912 that splits that vote. I mean, Wilson lost his own state. He lost New Jersey the second time.
Yep.
There was nobody to split the Republican
yep.
vote. So you really have to say there's a strong stream. The electorate has a strong presumption in favor of the party that's associated with the change of regime that came along with the crisis, the Civil War, say. Is your reading of it now that this really has dissolved, that there is no, that the lines are not taken? Because after all, it's not an arbitrary difference that separates the blue state of Connecticut from the red
yeah.
state of Wyoming.
Yeah.
No, that's not accidental. That's going to
yeah.
continue.
Well, I think, I mean, to take 1948 specifically, I think Truman wins after all, not by a lot, but he wins. I think a lot of that has to do with what Truman did as an incumbent. During his last
right.
3 years.
Right.
And he makes a move in civil rights. Roosevelt never did that. He becomes the big champion of civil rights. He recognizes Israel against Marshall's, General Marshall's, and Secretary Marshall's advice. He conducts the Berlin airlift. He takes a Cold War position and isolates the left by doing that. Isolate, again, by taking the civil rights position, he isolates the Dixies. He assembles a winning coalition by doing that. Moves by an incumbent. I mean, a challenger could not recognize Israel. A challenger could not conduct the Berlin airlift.
Okay.
Do those things. A challenger couldn't have been so adept, maybe anyway, at isolating the left the way Truman was and responding to the Czechoslovak takeover and all that. Besides statecraft, it's very... very effective politics. And he keeps the White House with a rather different coalition from what Roosevelt had in Roosevelt's 4 elections. I mean, Truman loses some of the deep southern states. He also loses the northeastern states, which Roosevelt always, and middle Atlantic states. Roosevelt had always taken them. Truman lost them all. He wins other way. It's a different... Truman lost New Jersey. He lost New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, and Delaware to Dewey in 1948. Where he runs very well in the Midwest and the West, which Roosevelt did also. It's a somewhat different coalition. It's a put-together coalition, partly by using the office for statecraft as well as for appeal. Now, what else was I going to say? I think that it's not unusual to have that happen. As you go from presidential election to presidential election, when you take out the person, the incumbent, the coalitional basis can shift a fair amount sometimes. Now, it doesn't always. But this red state, blue state stuff, that's, I mean, there's a continuity there between the, obviously, between the 2000 and 2004 election. But that can get shaken up. There may not be, the pattern may be somewhat different this year. You could get very different patterns. As it, Carter in 1976, his geographic pattern, his coalitional pattern, is very different from what the Democrats had put together in previous times, and so on. And also Reagan in 1980 runs better in the Southwest. He's basically a Southwestern guy. Look at it that way. These things are true. So, part of this is the coalitions are always changing. What the people do as incumbents has a considerable effect on, and often to the positive, to the gain of the White House, I think, in shaping those coalitions. Now, they lose. I mean, sometimes they screw up and lose. Obviously, Bush the father in 1992, he just kind of whipped out and lost the presidency. That can happen. For no obviously good reason. It wasn't like Hoover where the heavens came down on him. He just did a bad job, evidently, in the last year. That can happen, too. Is that responsive? We got more? We got more up there? Yes, sir.
Hey, I was looking through your first two tables, and you have, I was just looking through the past century, and there are five instances in which the incoming candidate lost the presidency. I think that's right. There was Wilson beating Taft in 1912, FDR beating Hoover in 1932, then Carter, Reagan, and Clinton. Yeah. And in four of those five, there are pretty good margins, at least 5%, in which the incumbent candidate lost. Yeah. And in three of those four, I would say Reagan, Clinton, and FDR, the candidate who won was kind of a revolutionary figure. People were really transcending politics in a lot of ways. So what it seems to me is that in order for an incumbent candidate to lose, it depends a lot more on who the challenger is than it does for the incumbent candidate.
Well, of course that'll be true. I mean, you get a good incumbent candidate like Reagan or FDR. Those are premium candidates, no question. Clinton's one of them too, probably. What were the three that you selected? You said those three.
Those.
I mean, look. I think if you were to have an immense data set with a lot of variables that you could put numbers to, I think that just plain great talent as a politician would enter in with a coefficient. I think probably it would load well onto FDR and this is back looking to be sure, and onto Reagan and probably onto Clinton in 1992. I think that's true. Sure enough. I mean, that's right. What would be some other instances of that? Let's see. Andrew Jackson in 1828 is a very good candidate. Again, it's not just Adams is weak, it's that Jackson was very strong as a politician, there's no question about that. Or Jefferson winning in 1800, a very strong challenger, no question about that. I mean, challengers will vary in how confident they are and how good they are at putting to coalitions. No, there's no question that that's a variable out there by itself, I think. Yeah. All right. Okay.
Join me in thanking Mayor for joining us.